Chapter 40. Retrieval. I can't help her myself. She's passed out of my reach, she continued. I think she's afraid of being a burden to me. When she was last here, 2 weeks ago, she seemed dreadfully worried about her future. She said Carrie Fisher was trying to find something for her to do. A few days later she wrote me that S.E. had taken a position as private secretary, and that I was not to be anxious, for everything was all right, and she would come in and tell me about it when S.E. had time. But S.E. has never come, and I don't like to go to her, because I am afraid of forcing myself on her when I'm not wanted. Once, when we were children, and I had rushed up after a long separation, and thrown my arms about her, she said, "Colin, please don't kiss me, unless I ask you to, Jerdy," and she did ask me, a minute later. But since then I've always waited to be asked. Selden had listened in silence, with the concentrated look which his thin dark face could assume when he wished to guard it against any involuntary change of expression. When his cousin ended, he said with a slight smile, "Colin, since you've learned the wisdom of waiting, I don't see why you urge me to rush in then," but the troubled appeal of her eyes made him mad. As he rose to take leave, "Colin, still, I'll do what you wish, and not hold you responsible for my failure." Selden's avoidance of Miss Bart had not been as unintentional as he had allowed his cousin to think. At first, indeed, while the memory of their last hour at Monte Carlo still held the full heat of his indignation, he had anxiously watched for her return. But as he had disappointed him by lingering in England, and when she finally reappeared it happened that business had called him to the West, whence he came back only to learn that she was starting for Alaska with the Gormers. The revelation of this suddenly established intimacy effectually chilled his desire to see her. If, at a moment when her whole life seemed to be breaking up, she could cheerfully commit its reconstruction to the Gormers, there was no reason why such accidents should ever strike her as irreparable. Every step she took seemed in fact to carry her farther from the region where, once or twice, he and S.E. had met for an illumined moment. And the recognition of this fact, when its first pang had been surmounted, produced in him a sense of negative relief. It was much simpler for him to judge Miss Bart by her habitual conduct than by the rare deviations from it which had thrown her so disturbingly in his way, and every act of hers which made the recurrence of such deviations more unlikely, confirmed the sense of relief with which he returned to the conventional view of her. But Jerdy Farish's words had sufficed to make him see how little this view was really his, and how impossible it was for him to live quietly with the thought of Lily Bart. To hear that she was in need of help, even such vague help as he could offer, was to be at once repossessed by that thought, and by the time he reached the street he had sufficiently convinced himself of the urgency of his cousin's appeal to turn his steps directly toward Lily's hotel. There his zeal met a check in the unforeseen news that Miss Bart had moved away, but, on his pressing his inquiries, the clerk remembered that S.E. had left an address, for which he presently began to search through his books. It was certainly strange that she should have taken this step without letting Jerdy Farish know of her decision, and Selden waited with a vague sense of uneasiness while the address was sought for. The process lasted long enough for uneasiness to turn to apprehension, but when at length a slip of paper was handed him, and he read on it, "Colon care of Mrs. Norma Hatch, Emporium Hotel," his apprehension passed into an incredulous stare, and this into the gesture of disgust with which he tore the paper in two, and turned to walk quickly homeward. When Lily woke on the morning after her translation to the Emporium Hotel, her first feeling was one of purely physical satisfaction. The force of contrast gave an added keenness to the luxury of lying once more in a soft pillowed bed, and looking across a spacious sunlit room at a breakfast table set invitingly near the fire. Analysis and introspection might come later. But for the moment she was not even troubled by the excesses of the upholstery, or the restless convolutions of the furniture. The sense of being once more lapped and folded in ease, as in some dense mild medium impenetrable to discomfort, effectually stilled the faintest note of criticism. When, the afternoon before, as he had presented herself to the lady to whom Carrie Fisher had directed her, as he had been conscious of entering a new world, Carrie's vague presentment of Mrs. Norma Hatch, whose reversion to her Christian name was explained as the result of her latest divorce, left her under the implication of coming from the West, with the not unusual extenuation of having brought a great deal of money with her. She was, in short, rich, helpless, unplaced. The very subject for Lily's hand. Mrs. Fisher had not specified the line her friend was to take. She owned herself unacquainted with Mrs. Hatch, whom she knew about through Melville Stancy, a lawyer in his leisure moments, and the Falstaff of a certain section of festive dub life. Socially, Mr. Stancy might have been said to form a connecting link between the Gormer world and the more dimly lit region on which Miss Bart now found herself entering. It was, however, only figuratively that the illumination of Mrs. Hatch's world could be described as dim. In actual fact, Lily found her seated in a blaze of electric light, impartially projected from various ornamental excrescences on a vast concavity of pink damask and gilding, from which she rose like Venus from her shell. The analogy was justified by the appearance of the lady, whose large-eyed prettiness had the fixity of something impaled and shown under glass. This did not preclude the immediate discovery that she was some years younger than her visitor, and that under her showiness, her ease, the aggression of her dress and voice, there persisted that ineradicable innocence which, in ladies of her nationality, so curiously coexists with startling extremes of experience. The environment in which Lily found herself was as strange to her as its inhabitants. She was unacquainted with the world of the fashionable New York hotel, a world overheated, over-upholstered, and overfitted with mechanical appliances for the gratification of fantastic requirements, while the comforts of a civilized life were as unattainable as in a desert. Through this atmosphere of torrid splendor moved wan beings as richly upholstered as the furniture, beings without definite pursuits or permanent relations, who drifted on a languid tide of curiosity from restaurant to concert hall, from palm garden to music room, from RT exhibit to dressmaker's opening. High-stepping horses or elaborately equipped motors waited to carry these ladies into vague metropolitan distances, whence they returned, still more wan from the weight of their sables, to be sucked back into the stifling inertia of the hotel routine. Somewhere behind them, in the background of their lives, there was doubtless a real past, peopled by real human activities. They themselves were probably the product of strong ambitions, persistent energies, diversified contacts with the wholesome roughness of life, yet they had no more real existence than the poet's shades in limbo. Lily had not been long in this pallid world without discovering that Mrs. Hatch was its most substantial figure. That lady, though still floating in the void, showed faint symptoms of developing an outline, and in this endeavor she was actively seconded by Mr. Melville Stancy. It was Mr. Stancy, a man of large resounding presence, suggestive of convivial occasions, and of a chivalry finding expression in Earth Night boxes and $1,000 bonbonnieres, who had transplanted Mrs. Hatch from the scene of her first development to the higher stage of hotel life in the metropolis. It was he who had selected the horses with which as he had taken the blue ribbon at the show, had introduced her to the photographer whose portraits of her formed the recurring ornament of Unday supplements, and had got together the group which constituted her social world. It was a small group still, with heterogeneous figures suspended in large unpeopled spaces, but Lily did not take long to learn that its regulation was no longer in Mr. Stancy's hands. As often happens, the pupil had outstripped the teacher, and Mrs. Hatch was already aware of heights of elegance as well as depths of luxury beyond the world of the emporium. This discovery at once produced in her a craving for higher guidance, for the adroit feminine hand which should give the right turn to her correspondence, the right hook to her hats, the right succession to the items of her menus. It was, in short, as the regulator of a germinating social life, that Miss Bart's guidance was required, her ostensible duties as secretary being restricted by the fact that Mrs. Hatch, as yet, knew hardly anyone to write to. The daily details of Mrs. Hatch's existence were as strange to Lily as its general tenor. The lady's habits were marked by an oriental indolence and disorder peculiarly trying to her companion. Mrs. Hatch and her friend seemed to float together outside the bounds of time and space. No definite hours were kept. No fixed obligations existed. Night and day flowed into one another in a blur of confused and retarded engagements, so that one had the impression of lunching at the tea hour, while dinner was often merged in the noisy after-theater supper which prolonged Mrs. Hatch's vigil till daylight. Through this jumble of futile activities came and went a strange throng of hangers-on manicures, beauty doctors, hairdressers, teachers of bridge, of French, of physical development. Figures sometimes indistinguishable, by their appearance, or by Mrs. Hatch's relation to them, from the visitors constituting her recognized society. But strangest of all to Lily was the encounter, in this latter group, of several of her acquaintances. As he had supposed, and not without relief, that she was passing, for the moment, completely out of her own circle, but she found that Mr. Stancy, one side of whose sprawling existence overlapped the edge of Mrs. Fisher's world, had drawn several of its brightest ornaments into the circle of the Emporium. To find Ned Silverton among the habitual frequenters of Mrs. Hatch's drawing room was one of Lily's first astonishments. But she soon discovered that he was not Mr. Stancy's most important recruit. It was on little Freddie Van Osburgh, the small slim heir of the Van Osburgh millions, that the attention of Mrs. Hatch's group was centered. Freddie, barely out of college, had risen above the horizon since Lily's eclipse, and she now saw with surprise what an effulgence he shed on the outer twilight of Mrs. Hatch's existence. This, then, was one of the things that young men entered for when released from the official social routine. This was the kind of revious engagement that so frequently caused them to disappoint the hopes of anxious hostesses. Lily had an odd sense of being behind the social tapestry, on the side where the threads were knotted and the loose ends hung. For a moment she found a certain amusement in the show, and in her own share of it. The situation had an ease and unconventionality distinctly refreshing after her experience of the irony of conventions. But these flashes of amusement were but brief reactions from the long disgust of her days. Compared with the vast gilded void of Mrs. Hatch's existence, the life of Lily's former friend seemed packed with ordered activities. Even the most irresponsible pretty woman of her acquaintance had her inherited obligations, her conventional benevolences, her share in the working of the great civic machine, and all hung together in the solidarity of these traditional functions. The performance of specific duties would have simplified Miss Bart's position, but the vague attendance on Mrs. Hatch was not without its perplexities. It was not her employer who created these perplexities. Mrs. Hatch showed from the first an almost touching desire for Lily's approval. Far from asserting the superiority of wealth, her beautiful eyes seemed to urge the plea of inexperience. She wanted to do what was ice, to be taught how to be ovally. The difficulty was to find any point of contact between her ideals and Lily's. Mrs. Hatch swam in a haze of indeterminate enthusiasms, of aspirations culled from the stage, the newspapers, the fashion journals, and a gaudy world of sport still more completely beyond her companion's ken. To separate from these confused conceptions those most likely to advance the lady on her way was Lily's obvious duty, but its performance was hampered by rapidly growing doubts. Lily was in fact becoming more and more aware of a certain ambiguity in her situation. It was not that as he had, in the conventional sense, any doubt of Mrs. Hatch's irreproachableness. The lady's offenses were always against taste rather than conduct. Her divorce record seemed due to geographical, rather than ethical conditions, and her worst laxities were likely to proceed from a wandering and extravagant good nature. But if Lily did not mind her detaining her manicure for luncheon, or offering the Odie doctor a seat in Freddie Van Osburgh's box at the play, she was not equally at ease in regard to some less apparent lapses from convention. Ned Silverton's relation to Stancy seemed, for instance, closer and less clear than any natural affinities would warrant, and both appeared united in the effort to cultivate Freddie Van Osburgh's growing taste for Mrs. Hatch. There was as yet nothing definable in the situation, which might well resolve itself into a huge joke on the part of the other two, but Lily had a vague sense that the subject of their experiment was too young, too rich and too credulous. Her embarrassment was increased by the fact that Freddie seemed to regard her as cooperating with himself in the social development of Mrs. Hatch, a view that suggested, on his part, a permanent interest in the lady's future. There were moments when Lily found an ironic amusement in this aspect of the case. The thought of launching such a missile as Mrs. Hatch at the perfidious bosom of society was not without its charm. Miss Bartlett even beguiled her leisure with visions of the fair Norma introduced for the first time to a family banquet at the Van Osburghs. But the thought of being personally connected with the transaction was less agreeable, and her momentary flashes of amusement were followed by increasing periods of doubt. The sense of these doubts was uppermost when, late one afternoon, she was surprised by a visit from Lawrence Selden. He found her alone in the wilderness of pink damask, for in Mrs. Hatch's world the tea hour was not dedicated to social rites, and the lady was in the hands of her masseuse. Selden's entrance had caused Lily an inward start of embarrassment, but his air of constraint had the effect of restoring her self-possession, and she took at once the tone of surprise and pleasure, wondering frankly that he should have traced her to so unlikely a place, and asking what had inspired him to make the search. Selden met this with an unusual seriousness. As he had never seen him, so little master of the situation, so plainly at the mercy of any obstructions she might put in his way. I wanted to see you, he said, and she could not resist observing in reply that he had kept his wishes under remarkable control, as he had in truth felt his long absence as one of the chief bitternesses of the last months. His desertion had wounded sensibilities far below the surface of her pride. Selden met the challenge with directness. Why should I have come, unless I thought I could be of use to you? It is my only excuse for imagining you could want me. This struck her as a clumsy evasion, and the thought gave a flash of keenness to her answer. Then you have come now, because you think you can be of use to me? He hesitated again. Why yes. In the modest capacity of a person, to talk things over with. For a clever man it was certainly a stupid beginning, and the idea that his awkwardness was due to the fear of her attaching a personal significance to his visit chilled her pleasure in seeing him. Even under the most adverse conditions, that pleasure always made itself felt. She might hate him, but as he had never been able to wish him out of the room, she was very near hating him now. Yet the sound of his voice, the way the light fell on his thin dark hair, the way he sat and moved, and wore his clothes, she was conscious that even these trivial things were inwoven with her deepest life. In his presence a sudden stillness came upon her, and the turmoil of her spirit ceased, but an impulse of resistance to this stealing influence now prompted her to say, "It's very good of you to present yourself in that Gutenberg edition." End of chapter.